Okay, good. All right, welcome everybody to Zion's Trumpet, another Sunday night. How's everybody doing this evening? This happy Easter. Irma says peaceful. That's good. Good. Wonderful. Well, I guess people probably haven't come today, so maybe it won't be too many in the chat room today. Anybody have anything you'd like to share before we get started? Nobody has anything yet, huh? Let's see. You ready for some songs? King, I want to hear the kingdom's call. I want to climb Zion's mountain. I want to see great Babylon fall. I want to see Jesus reigning upon King David's royal throne. Oh, won't that be a glorious sight to see when Israel comes marching home? I want to see Israel marching. I want to hear the kingdom's call. I want to climb Zion's mountain. I want to see great Babylon fall. I want to see Jesus reigning upon King David's royal throne. Oh, won't that be a glorious sight to see when Israel comes marching home? I want to see Israel marching. I want to hear the kingdom's call. I want to climb Zion's mountain. I want to see great Babylon fall. I want to see Jesus reigning upon King David's royal throne. Oh, won't that be a glorious sight to see when Israel comes marching home? I want to see Israel marching. I want to hear the kingdom's call. I want to find Zion's mountain. I want to see great Babylon fall. I want to see Jesus reigning upon King David's royal throne. Oh, won't that be a glorious sight to see when Israel comes marching home? I want to see Israel marching. I want to hear the kingdom's call. I want to climb Zion's mountain. I want to see great Babylon fall. I want to see Jesus reigning upon King David's royal throne. Oh, won't that be a glorious sight to see when Israel comes marching home? Amen. So brethren, come see the tomb where Jesus laid his call. Brethren, come see the tomb where Jesus lay. That stone's been rolled away. That stone's been rolled away. Death couldn't hold him, much less the grave. Since that stone's been rolled away. And now he's risen. And now he's reigning. And with him my heart is singing songs of praise. Now he's risen, and now he's reigning. Since that stone's been rolled away. Brethren, come see the tomb where Jesus lay. That stone's been rolled away. That stone's been rolled away. Death couldn't hold him, much less the grave. Since that stone's been rolled away. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning. And within my heart he's singing songs of praise. Now he's risen, and now he's reigning. Since that stone's been rolled away. Brethren, come see the tomb where Jesus lay. That stone's been rolled away. That stone's been rolled away. Death couldn't hold him, much less the grave, since that stone's been rolled away. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning, and within my heart he's singing songs of praise. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning, since that stone's been rolled away. Brethren, come see the tomb where Jesus lay. That stone's been rolled away. That stone's been rolled away. Death couldn't hold him, much less the grave, since that stone's been rolled away. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning, and within my heart he's singing songs of praise. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning, since that stone's been rolled away. Brethren, come see the tomb where Jesus lay. That stone's been rolled away. That stone's been rolled away. Bless the grave, since that stone's been rolled away. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning, and within my heart he's singing songs of praise. Now he's risen, and now he's reigning, since that stone's been rolled away. And now he's risen, and now he's reigning, and within my heart he's singing songs of praise. Now he's risen, and now he's reigning, since that stone's been rolled away.
Let's see, anybody else have anything before we start? Okay, well, since it's Easter, I thought I'd look at a few things regarding this time of year as it relates to our life in Christ. I'd like to start off by sharing something that's not really, not very deep, but I still think it's pretty interesting. I was doing some research this week regarding the term Easter in Acts 12:4. I'm sure most of you, you know, have heard that term Easter there in that passage is wrong. It should be translated Passover, right? Well, I never bought into that argument for several reasons, which I'll explain. But the first one was because the passage itself says that Peter was arrested by King Herod during the days of unleavened bread. I don't know if anybody noticed that. During the days of unleavened bread. Let me read it to you quick. It's Acts 12, 1-4. It says, now about that time Herod, the king, stretched forth his hand to vex certain of the church, and he killed James, the brother John, with a sword. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Then were the days of unleavened bread. And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people. Okay? In order to understand why I never really bought the argument that that shouldn't be Easter, that should be Passover, I'm the first choir to go up to Jerusalem three times a year. Each of those three times, a religious festival was held. We commonly refer to these three festivals as feasts. Two of these feasts are broken up into sub-feasts. For instance, Passover is a combination of feasts. Passover is the day of Passover with the Passover meal. Then there's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which lasts for 7 days. And then there's a day or the Feast of First Fruits, which is one day after that. Tabernacles also is broken up into sub-feasts. It's a combination of the day of the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and a seven-day celebration called the Feast of Booths, or the Tabernacles proper. The second feast, the second festival of the year, it's called the Feast of Weeks. That has no sub-feast. It's a Feast of Passover, which includes Passover, Unleavened Bread, First Fruits, then the Feast of Weeks, or Feast of First Fruits, then the Feast of Tabernacles, which includes Trumpets, Atonement, and Booths, or Tabernacles proper. There's been some confusion over a few of these terms. For instance, when you talk about First Fruits, that could either be a reference to the day which comes at the end of the Passover festival, or it could be a reference to the day which makes up the second feast, the Feast of Weeks, which comes 50 days after the Passover. Another bit of confusion comes from the names which apply to the Feast of Passover. This is very interesting. Although the term Passover is regarded as a feast, as a festival, there's only one place in the entire Old Testament where it's referred to as a festival. It's in Ezekiel 45:21. It says, in the first month, in the 14th day of the month, you shall have the Passover, a feast of 7 days. Unleavened bread shall be eaten. Okay? Everywhere else in the Old Testament, the term Passover is talking about either the day, the Passover, or the meal that's eaten on that day, the meal itself. It's a reference to a single day, the day of Passover. The actual name of Israel's first religious festival of the year is really the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For instance, in the main passages where God lays out these feasts and gives people the instructions for these feasts is in Exodus and Deuteronomy. And in both these places, the first feast is not called Passover. It's called Unleavened Bread. In Exodus 23, verses 14 through 17, this is what it says. 3 times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in a year. Thou shalt keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days as I commanded thee in the time appointed of the month of Abib. For in it thou camest out from Jerusalem, and none shall appear before me empty. And the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of the labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the Feast of Ingathering, which is the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. 3 times in the year all thy male shall appear before the Lord God. In Deuteronomy, when these 3 feasts are laid out, it says this in Deuteronomy 16, verses 16 and 17. 3 times a year shall all thy males appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he hath given thee. So except for that one passage in Ezekiel, the term Passover in the Old Testament is always a reference to the actual meal or the day the meal's eaten. And, you know, if you don't believe that, it's fine. You can check it out yourself. You get yourself a concordance, and you look up the word feasts. You'll see multiple references to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Tabernacles, but only one reference to the Feast of Passover. And that reference is talking about a meal. It's talking about the meal, not the whole festival. And then if you go and look up the word Passover in your concordance, you're going to find that every time, every instance is talking about the day the meal is eaten or else the meal itself. Passover is simply the first day or the first part of Unleavened Bread. I believe there's a reason for that, but I'll get to that a little later. So the order of this first feast is given in Leviticus chapter 23. What's this first feast? You know, how you're supposed to celebrate it. It's in Leviticus 23. It's in verses 4 through 8. It says, these are the feasts of the Lord, even holy convocations, which ye shall proclaim in their seasons. In the 14th day of the first month, even it is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread unto the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. In the first day you shall have an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein, but you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord 7 days. In the seventh day is the holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. So that, you know, the Passover is clearly said to be on the 14th day of the first month, while the days of unleavened bread start on the 15th day, the day after that. Okay, and they last for 7 days. For 7 days after the Passover, the day of Passover, the children of Israel were to eat unleavened bread. And the first of the seventh of those days were Sabbaths, supposed to be holy convocation to the Lord. So, when the writer of Acts said Peter was arrested during the days of unleavened bread, this is a specific reference to the 7 days after the day of Passover. Okay, you understand that? It's Passover, then unleavened bread, which is 7 days, and then first fruits, which is 1 day. Now, the word translated Easter in Acts 12:4 is Pascha. It's Strong 3957. I have this information down in my notes. It's an Aramaic word, not a Greek word. And it's consistently translated Passover throughout the New Testament, except there in Acts 12. Now, since Passover is always a reference to the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread in the Old Testament, I've always thought that, you know, it's quite logical, I think, to think that Easter is a correct translation here in Acts 12, because there's no way King Herod will be waiting for Pascha, that is, the day of Passover, to kill Peter when Pascha was already passed, you know, come and gone. Pascha is a reference to the day. And after the Pascha comes the days of unleavened bread. So if he was arrested during the days of unleavened bread, he was actually arrested after the day of Passover. So unless Herod was planning on keeping him until the next Passover, which is a year away, you know, I've always assumed and seen it was absurd to say he was waiting to kill Peter till after Passover, because he didn't arrest him till after Passover. there were some other factors why I always rejected that view. One of them was because there's no Greek equivalent for the term Easter. And I thought, well, that might be one reason they use Pascha to refer to a pagan holiday. Secondly, Easter was a pagan festival that was celebrated by the Romans around the same time as Passover. Okay, so all these things are in my mind, and I just, whenever anybody said that should be Passover, I thought, well, I don't think so. I don't think so. Anyway, I was reading some information about this the other day, just going through some articles for no particular reason. I don't even know why I was doing it. And I was reading an article from a guy who was, he had my same position. He was defending the translation of Easter there in this article. But something he said jumped out at me. I'll read you what this little comment here he said jumped out at me in this article. He says, it must be noted that whenever the Passover is mentioned in the New Testament, the reference is always to the meal, to be eaten on the night of April 14th, not the entire week. The days of unleavened bread are never referred to as Passover. It must be remembered that the angel of the Lord passed over Egypt on one night, not seven nights in a row. Okay, so he's putting forth the same idea that I have. For the first time, this thought occurred to me, if Passover was never referred to as the whole feast, if it was just like in the Old Testament, it's only the day, is that the same way it was in the New Testament? So I went through the New Testament the other day, and I checked to see if that was the case. And when I did, I was surprised to find out that on at least one occasion, and it looks like to me two or three other ones, really, but clearly on one occasion, Pascha is a reference to the whole entire festival of unleavened bread, not just the first day of that festival. And it's in Luke 22:1, and it says, now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. Okay? Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. So actually, when you examine all the passages in the New Testament, there's several, like I said, which use the word Pascha, Passover, to refer to the entire feast of unleavened bread. Pascha in the New Testament is used to refer to the Passover meal itself, or the day the meal is eaten, or the entire festival, or a combination of any of those three. So when it says that Herod was intending after Pascha to kill Peter, Pascha could be a reference to the whole feast. He could have been waiting till after Pascha the festival, not Pascha the day, to bring Peter out to kill him. Do you ever understand that? Anyways, at this point, you know, I'm no longer sure Easter was the correct translation there. But I wasn't yet convinced Passover was right either. So I start digging a little deeper. And I found out that Pascha, the term Pascha, which is always translated Passover in the New Testament, that had been translated as Easter throughout the entire New Testament in earlier translations of the Bible, earlier in the King James, particularly in William Tyndale's New Testament. Okay? So William Tyndale and Coverdale, those guys, when they saw Pascha in the New Testament, they translated Easter all the way through. It wasn't just in Acts 12. And actually, with the translators of the King James Bible, what they actually did was they went through the Bible and they corrected all those references to Easter and turned them into Passover, except the one in Acts. They chose to keep that one reference there, and I don't know why. You know, maybe they felt Passover was wrong for the same reason I did. Maybe they had some other reason. I don't know. But, you know, they kept that word there. But what I realized was the King James translators didn't just stick that word in there, you know, for no reason because they had some kind of hidden agenda, you know, Catholic or otherwise. That word was all through that New Testament. They took them all out. They took Easter out of all the references except for that one in Acts. So the people who go around saying that the translators put Easter in there for some nefarious reason, they're wrong. Right now, it looks to me like the term Pascha probably should have been translated Passover. Pascha was a term for the whole entire feast. In the Old Testament, it was not. It was only a term for the day or the meal. But in the New Testament, two or three times, it's clearly said to be the whole entire feast. All right, so that term Easter probably should have been Passover. I just thought I wanted to share that with you since it's Easter. And you can consider all those facts for yourselves and make your own decision. You know, I have no hidden agenda there to push. I'm not a King James only person. I don't think the King James version is perfect and without error. So I don't waste my time trying to prove that. But at the same time, I don't agree with the people who think the King James is inferior, all right, to these later versions, because it's not. Overall, the King James is far superior to any of the versions out there, and it's certainly the safest Bible to read. There's all kinds of bad errors in the other Bibles. Bad, bad, bad errors. The few errors that are in King James pale in significance to the major errors that are in the other Bibles, all right? So anyway, I never said publicly whether I agree or disagree with that Easter thing. I always kind of kept to myself. But so now I'm saying publicly that I believe that's true. It should have been Passover. Now, I want to get back to why Israel's first feast was called Unleavened Bread instead of Passover. I mean, you can't call it Passover. I'm just saying it was called unleavened bread in the Old Testament, okay? I think the reason they called it unleavened bread was because, you see, the majority of that feast has to do with staying away from leaven. And I think God wanted to emphasize the fact that the people carried a great deal of responsibility when they participated in this particular feast. It's important to notice this kind of stuff because it plays out in the New Testament. There's a spiritual reality to this. Under the Old Testament, that was the shadow. There's a reality of it in the New Testament. Now, under this first feast, the unleavened bread, God's the one who provided the forgiveness and the justification represented by the blood of the Passover lamb. Okay, partaking of the Passover lamb in the Old Testament Israel, it represented Israel's deliverance from Egypt, which represents deliverance from the world. Okay, so eating the Passover represented the fact that God did something for the people of Israel that they could never do for themselves. Okay, God did something for the people that they could never do for themselves. However, immediately after celebrating the reality that God did something for them which they could never do for themselves, you see, he commanded them to abstain from leaven for 7 days. And what does avoiding leaven represent to us? Well, I believe avoiding leaven, the representation of that, the reality of that, the New Testament, represents not partaking of things that are sinful. Okay, there's two kinds of leaven spoken of in the New Testament. One's good kind because it represents good things. The other's an evil kind because it represents, you know, evil things. So the leaven that's referred to in the Old Testament they're supposed to avoid represents the bad kind of spiritual leaven that you see in the New Testament. Having natural Israel eat unleavened bread for 7 days is a type and shadow of us not partaking of anything that's spiritually sinful, spiritual leaven, after we're born again, after we have partaken of the Passover lamb. Passover lamb is for us. This was for them. It's a spiritual thing, spiritual reality. So that literal feast was a picture of something, a reality that would be revealed and be available under the New Testament. When we're born again, we partake spiritually of the true Passover lamb. And of course, we have to freely choose to accept that lamb as an atonement for our sin. But once we choose to accept the sacrifice, the rest has to be done by God. You know, God has to forgive us. God has to cleanse us. God has to justify us. Okay, he has to give a spirit to our, he has to send his spirit into our spirit. He was born again, regenerated, all kinds of, everything has to come from God. So God does for us what we can never do for ourselves by being good, by being commandments or laws or whatever. But immediately after we're born again, back on our shoulders to no longer partake of spiritual leaven for 7 spiritual days. Okay, 7 is a number of completion or perfection. So in the New Testament, the 7 days in Israel symbolizes our whole spiritual journey. So first we partake of the lamb, the true Passover lamb. We have a born-again experience. We're forgiven and justified. And immediately, we have to go into the 7 days of unleavened bread. That is, the rest of our journey has to be spent avoiding spiritual leaven, which is sin, okay, worldliness and sin. So there's several types of leaven clearly defined in the New Testament. I'd like to take a few minutes to look at them. The first is going to be in Matthew 16, 6 through 8 and 11 through 12, okay? Then Jesus said unto them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have taken no bread. Which when Jesus perceived, he said unto them, O ye of little faith, why reason ye among yourselves because ye have brought no bread? How is it that you do not understand that I speak it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Then understood they how he bade them not to beware of the leaven of the bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So here, Jesus refers to bad doctrine as leaven. And this is our responsibility, to stay away from bad doctrine. And you'll never be able to stay away from bad doctrine unless you understand what bad doctrine is. You got to care about doctrine and learn doctrine, learn the difference between true and false doctrine before you can ever stay away from bad doctrine. You see, the influence of bad doctrine in our lives is no joke because false doctrines are not harmless. It's not just a bunch of men's opinions. Not only do they blind people to the truth, miss God's perfect will for their lives in many areas, many times bad doctrine actually contains supernatural power because it's been formulated, it's been conceived by demon spirits. And when you come under the power of a doctrine that's been formulated by a demon spirit, you come under the power of that spirit. And it's this type of doctrine is going to be the leaven that's prominent in the last days. It's going to be this type of doctrine, this type of leaven, that's going to have the power to destroy God's people in the last days. This type of leaven is going to be the thing that's an integral part of the end time apostasy. That's why Paul said in latter times, some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and the doctrines of devils. It's a very dangerous kind of leaven, in the last days especially. So when anyone tells you that doctrine isn't important, it's all about love, it's all about relationships, it's all about experience, you know, a red flag should go up in our spirits, because only Satan would tell us not to worry about doctrine when there's such an emphasis in the New Testament on learning, teaching, maintaining, defending, you know, if need be, dividing over doctrine. Another kind of leaven is found in Luke 12:1. It says, in the meantime, when they were gathered together, an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch as they trode upon one another. First of all, beware ye of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Okay? So here Jesus refers to hypocrisy as leaven. Hypocrisy is basically pretending to be something you're not, like an actor casting a play or in a movie or something. However, it can go much deeper than a conscious knowing pretending to be something we aren't. Many times hypocrisy has become really a self-deception that people are caught in because they actually believe they're something or not. You know, they're not just pretending as far as they're concerned. They really believe the lie they're living. And when a person realizes they're pretending to be something or somebody they're not, there's hope for them because they can be, they always can be convicted of that lie until their conscience becomes seared. Once their conscience becomes seared, there is very little hope for them because they no longer realize they're pretending. They no longer realize they're pretending. They no longer have the capacity to understand they're pretending. You know, the ability to see the truth is just lost to them forever once their conscience is seared, unless God performs a mighty miracle, you know, in their lives and restores their conscience, which I've seen happen. So anyway, natural leaven, you put natural leaven to a ball of dough, you know, it affects the whole ball of dough, it affects the whole thing. It permeates the whole lump, right? Hypocrisy does the same thing in our lives if it's not checked. When religious people are hypocrites, when they're living a lie, whether they know it or not, they never, of course, view themselves as jerks or hypocrites or scoundrels or lawbreakers. Of course, you know, they always view themselves as heroes, as honest people, as good people, as righteous people, you know, full of noble motives, noble intentions and all that. And just like natural leaven puffs up the dough, so the leaven of hypocrisy puffs up the hypocrite. And just like the person has to punch down the dough when it rises, so God has to come along and punch us down when the hypocrisy that's in us starts puffing us up. So it's best that we voluntarily ask God to show us any of that leaven of hypocrisy that's in us today so we can deal with it now and get free from it now, lest we have to face it at the judgment, right? That's why the very next thing Jesus said there, hypocrisy, the very next thing he says was, in 12, 2 and 3, he says, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known. Therefore, whatever you that which you have spoken in the ear, in the ear, in closets, shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. All right? So Jesus, you know, warned them. He's saying, look, you know, if you don't voluntarily seek the Lord now for wisdom in light in this whole area, tomorrow you're going to find out that God has no choice but to expose those hidden things and those secrets to everybody. So it's much better to cooperate with God and be punched down now by him privately, just between us and him, than to have him punch us down openly before the entire creation when he returns. Right? Everybody agree to that? So on a count of three, I want everybody to say these words. Please punch me down, Lord. Right? On a count of three. One, two, three. Please punch me down, Lord. Okay, next one is Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, 14 and 15. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread. Neither had they in the ship with them more than one loaf. And he charged them, saying, take heed, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And the leaven of Herod. And here Jesus refers to a certain kind of leaven called the leaven of Herod, but he never really explains what that leaven is. You never find an explanation in Scripture for that. Of course, and different people have come up with different views on what this leaven is. My view is that since Herod was a political leader at the time, it must have been something to do with the realm of politics. Right? My guess is the leaven of Herod is some kind of conversion of religion and politics. That is, like using religion for wicked political purposes. You know, the Pharisees were the fundamentalist wing of Judaism that day. The Sadducees were like the liberal wing of Judaism. And the Sadducees had chosen to make some political compromises and agreements with Rome, with the ruling country. Okay? And as a result, Rome decreed that the chief priest would be a Sadducee. So the Sadducees were, you know, what you might call political bedfellows with King Herod. And King Herod wasn't a Jew. He wasn't Jewish. So he didn't observe the Jewish feast. He didn't obey the Jewish law. He was a sinner. He was a murderer. He was an adulterer, a liar. And he was everything else that you would expect from a political ruler who was desperate to get power and maintain power, right? But he was also religious. And he knew how to use religion, including the Judaism of that day, to further his political goals. So, you know, my view of the leaven of Herod is, you know, that's when you mix the wickedness of the world, and especially the political world, with true religion, with Christianity, in order to get what you want out of life, in order to get what you want out of this life. You're mixing the world with the true religion in order to get what you want out of this life. All right? 1 Corinthians is another kind of leaven.